Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public, and tonight we bring you another discussion from Humanities ND's Game Changer series. Now, if you were talking about politics, not sports, what do you think the final five would be? And why is there a problem with the Hastert rule? What is the Hastert rule? And what is the difference between the square inches of paper taken up by the Constitution versus the square inches of paper taken up by the rules and procedures of the House or the Senate? Listen to Catherine Gell, who you will hear soon, and you will understand why these are issues. Catherine's background is in business, but she doesn't want to run government like a business. Business analysis, however, has made her think that the big problem with the U.S. Congress is that the incentives are wrong, and she's got a way to change it. Which makes sense, then, that it would be part of the Game Changer series. They decided this year to focus it on critical issues facing our democracy, and I should mention that it's sponsored in part by the Paris Family Foundation. Catherine Gell is interviewed by Dave Ailes, who's head of the American Bank Corps, an employee-owned bank in western North Dakota and eastern Montana. So keep listening. There's some interesting ideas ahead.
The topic today is political innovation, right? And what do we do to change our political system? And the first thought that I had after reading your book and the first question is, could have you have picked a more perfect, and I struggle with the word if it's perfect, a better year to publish a book on this topic?
You know, I totally know why you're struggling with that word perfect, because, you know, there are so many of us in this country are frustrated with where we've come, where we're at with what's going on in Washington, D.C., and also how divided we seem, you know, throughout the country. So I will say that a more perfect time would have been if I could have published it like 8 years ago, or maybe even a decade ago, and we could have changed some of the systemic things that really exacerbated and contributed to the predicament that we found ourselves now in, where we seem so divided. And so that would have been better. Although the question is, would people have known that we needed to change? So coming back, the fact is I published the book when I did and didn't have those ideas 10 years ago. And now the truth is that people are really, here's what I say. I feel like we've entered a time period where there's a competition of ideas, where we're not just looking at candidates right now after this election, we're looking around and saying collectively, Republicans, Democrats, independents, people across the ideological spectrum, how can we not do this again? How can we alter this trajectory we're on? And so in that sense, it is a perfect time, because what I'm offering into that conversation and what's really being received quite well is this idea of changing the incentives in our elections.
Thank you. And we'll get into that in just a minute. Before we start talking about your ideas, Catherine, I'd like the audience to learn a little bit more about your background, because you don't come from the politics industry. You come from business, right? And I think that gives you a great perspective. And, you know, disruption often does not come from within an industry, right? So maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you met Michael Porter and kind of the origins of your passion.
Fantastic. So yes, Dave, I'm a business person. I spent really all of my career until 5 years ago in business. I should say I had a couple stints at Chicago Public Schools and the mayor's office. So I knew enough. I knew my way around enough in the public sector. But my career, my success comes from business and everything, you know, that I have then learned. And I wouldn't be now here working on, quote, the politics industry or these innovations if it weren't for that business lens. My company that I ran for the last 10 years of my business career was in Wisconsin. I like to confirm for everybody that we did make cheese. This is actually how I've put it recently in my TED talk. You know, it was through that business lens where I'm saying, oh, in my business, in order to do well, I have to have my customers like my cheese and like everything about it, like the cost, like the value, like the taste. And then I have to keep making the product better and better. And if I don't, and my customers are dissatisfied, then they take their business somewhere else. So that seems like healthy competition. It pushes innovation, and both me as the supplier and my customers are happy. And there became a central question as I was a business executive who also cared deeply about the trajectory of the country. And I was engaged in traditional ways in politics. And I started thinking, none of this is working. And I'm very dissatisfied. And so is everyone that I know. How is it that in the politics industry, the suppliers, the companies, the parties, the Democrats, the Republicans, and everybody, you know, sort of in that business of politics seems to be doing better than ever, meaning more money in campaigns, more ads, more revenue, more power, doing better than ever, even as their customers, the citizens, the voters, have never been more dissatisfied. So I thought, shouldn't be that way. This, by the way, this is not saying government should act like a business. This is talking about competition in the politics industry. And that was the central question. Now, the breakthrough that led me to this current work came when I was working on my company's strategy. So you asked me how I met Michael Porter. Now, Michael Porter, I mean, some of you may know, but he's a very famous, perhaps the most famous Harvard Business School professor. And he essentially created, he's considered the father of modern corporate strategy. And I had the pleasure to work with him when I was redoing my corporate strategy. So in sum, it's sort of complicated, but it comes down to how can I sell more cheese, right? And while I was doing that project, we were using a classic business tool called the Five Forces, and it analyzes any industry. And one half of my brain was working on food manufacturing, and the other half was basically having light bulb moment after light bulb moment after light bulb moment. Oh my goodness, this describes what's happening in politics exactly. This shows why my customers are happy and why their customers are not happy. It shows why their companies are growing despite that. And it also shows why we never have any new competitors. Because usually, if there's a lot of money in an industry, and the customers are unhappy, an entrepreneur says, oh my gosh, what a great business opportunity. I'll come in and I'll create something new that the customers want, but that never happens in politics. And this analysis showed why that was so. And out of that came this opportunity to use that analysis to take the argument to business people as a new way of looking at what was wrong. But most importantly, it really clarified what of all the things that could be better would be most powerful in changing the results if we were to change it? You know, because we didn't want to sort of just explain why everything was screwed up in a new and interesting way. We wanted to say, and so what should we do? And I was lucky. I was able to go with this whole analysis to Michael Porter and ask him to be my co-author, which really had a huge benefit of giving this instant credibility, because of course the Five Forces had not been used, you know, for politics before. And so given that I was showing up with this entirely new way of looking at things, his buy-in really helped us get a fast start.
Thank you. Well, you know, one of the things that whenever I talk about politics with colleagues, carefully talk about politics, I guess, the question that always comes up, and I think it leads to really the underpinnings of your argument, is why don't we have better choices, right, when it comes to the final, the elections, and why can't anything happen? Why can't they do anything? And so maybe could you, if you could use that as a segue into why don't we have better choices? What is wrong with our system that creates the issues we have today?
Let me say something to everybody who I can't see, but who is nicely attending today. What I'm about to say is about the system. So I'm going to say the Democrats, the Republicans, you don't need to be at all looking for what side I'm on. I actually call myself politically homeless, which, you know, actually then a lot of people resonate with that. But I'm really talking about the system, and a lot of the people who are in the system are as much prisoners of the system as the customers are. So let's think about the system as being the evil part and not look specifically, you know, at individuals right now, because it's not going to help us change what we need to change. All right, now to answer your question, why don't we have better choices? I want to say one thing.
what we want to do eventually is have us all be able to think even further than better choices, think about why don't we have better results from Congress? And that is in part, maybe we need better choices, maybe we need, quote, better candidates, but it's far more certain that the reason we don't have good results is because no matter what choices we have, they're sort of prisoners of the system. Here's what I mean. The way we run elections in the US, federal elections, so let's just talk about Congress. It's not about the presidency, not about your state legislature. In Congress, we have two-party primaries, a Democrat primary, Republican primary. One from each side advances. And then those are our only two choices, if even, because sometimes we know there's no competition because if it's a red district, maybe a Democrat doesn't even bother running because they know they're not going to win, or the other way around in a blue district. You might go to the ballot in November and see some names you'd never heard of before and realize these other people are also running, you know, that they're third parties or independents and they got on through signatures, but they're sort of immaterial to us, right? This party primary has a really phenomenally deleterious effect on our ability to solve problems in Washington, D.C., because what happens is primaries are low turnout. I'll give some general figures are that 15% of people turn out for primaries. So let's just call it that 7.5% are in the Republican primary and 7.5% in the Democratic primary. And in 80% of elections for Congress, we know who won when we know who won the primary, which means that let's say that my election here is now a red district. It's a Republican district. So these people, these 7.5%, are going to pick the Republican winner of the primary, and then it's a done deal, which means that 7.5% of Republicans are picking that seat. And in blue districts, 7.5%, well, I'm sorry, 7.5% of people are picking that winner in the red district, and 7.5% are picking the Democrats. And the voters, these 7.5%, they're not just a smaller portion of citizens, voters overall. Voters in party primaries, I mean, kudos to them because they're participating actively, and they tend to be more ideological than voters as a whole. And that's why we sort of are aware of this, that primaries push people to the right and to the left. And we think of that as hurting our choices, but I want to jump beyond that. The biggest problem with the primary is not that we don't like what we see in November. It's that no matter who wins, when they're in Congress and they actually have to do the work, let's say they have an opportunity to solve a pressing national problem, things that haven't been solved, like healthcare, immigration, our fiscal situation, our national debt, the infrastructure challenges we have. When they evaluate what they're going to do, it would make sense that your senator would say, is this a good idea? Is this the right policy for the country, for my state? Is this what the majority of my constituents want? But it's actually none of that. The question that is foremost is, will I make it back through? Will I win again in my next party primary if I vote for this bipartisan consensus solution? And if the answer to that is no, and on all the big issues for Democrats and Republicans, the answer is almost always no, then it's better to do nothing than to do something that is less than exactly what your side wants. And so that makes all the important questions fundamentally irrelevant. So how I put it is that our party primaries have created a proverbial eye of the needle. You know how the rich man like can't get to heaven? It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle. Well, I tell you, it's easier for like 10 camels to go through an eye of the needle than for a problem-solving, you know, politician to sign bipartisan consensus legislation on the hot issues and win their party primary. They can't do it. And watch the news right now. You're going to see it all the time. Primary has long ago ceased to be just a noun, like the primary. It's almost always a verb now. So-and-so said that because they're going to get primaried. if they don't say that. So-and-so voted that way because they're afraid that they're going to get primaried, which is the threat of both sides. As in, if you don't hew to this Republican line, to this Democratic line, we're going to primary you out of existence. That's what we're going to take you out. And so you can't have, 435 people in Congress and divide them into warring teams and then say, now let's get important, challenging, complicated stuff done where we have to make trade-offs. Never going to work. So we don't like our choices, but the main thing is they don't get good results. We have to get rid of the party primary system and replace it with something that doesn't have that negative effect. And it's, we'll get to that in the solutions.
We talk about the primaries, but the other thing that we don't see in our systems, we never see anybody outside one of the major parties be competitive, right? And I think this comes down to plurality voting and how the system, if you can get onto a ballot, then how it also prevents, outside contenders from coming in.
Yeah. Let's give an example for the audience. So what Dave has just talked about here is that there's a choice that we made in our election system that was made when the country was founded about how we would pick our winners that is really hurting us today. And in fact, if someone were designing a democracy from scratch today, nobody would pick this, but we were first. So, we made a choice and it turns out it was not good. So now we should change. But here's what the choice was. We decided that the person who would win the election would be the person with the most votes. And that sounds super logical. Sounds fair. It sounds right. Sounds all those things. But it turns out it's actually a real problem because in any election with more than two candidates, look, so you have a Republican, a Democrat, and now you have an independent, which you're getting at, someone could win with less than majority support. So in a three-way race, you could split the votes pretty much three ways, and one of those candidates could win with 34% support. And that doesn't seem very fair, it doesn't seem very democratic, all those things. But the real problem, once again, is that it has a worse effect in competition. Voting that way, letting the person with the most votes wins, even if they don't have a majority, creates what we call the spoiler effect. Essentially, it keeps new competitors out because this is how it works. Think back to the election of 2016, even though my focus is not on the presidency, I'm going to use that as a reference. So in 2016, we had Trump and Hillary, and we had Jill Stein running on the left as the Green Party candidate, and we had Gary Johnson running to the right of Trump as the Libertarian Party candidate. And voters who liked Jill Stein on the left were told, oh, great to like her, but don't you dare actually vote for her. That would be crazy because you'll just take votes away from Hillary. You'll spoil the election for her. You'll be a spoiler and you'll inadvertently help elect Trump. And voters on the right who wanted to support Gary Johnson were told, don't vote for the guy, even though this is a democracy. Don't vote for him because he's never going to win. He's just going to spoil the election for Trump. And that is sort of like almost like the curse word that is put on the label that's put on top of anyone who wants to compete against what we call the duopoly, the Democrats and Republicans who are entrenched. If you don't have the threat of new competition in any industry, then the players don't actually have to serve certain customers because no one else is going to take their business. Like sometimes I discuss this with everybody, by the way. So like I'll discuss this with my before in COVID when I used to be able to every once in a while get a manicure, then I'd have this discussion. I would say, and think how much you could charge if you were the only salon in this whole entire city. And then you could do the nails badly and you would still win. And then everybody says, I convince people one by one that way. But my point is you have to have new competition. So we have to get rid of the spoiler argument. This is a good place to say, I don't have any problem with the Democrats or the Republicans per se, as I said before. I don't have a problem with political parties at all. We need parties and ways to associate and be engaged. And I don't even have any problem with just two major parties. Here's the problem, that the current two are guaranteed to remain the only two ongoingly, regardless of what they do or don't get done on behalf of their customers, the public interest. So by opening up competition so that Gary Johnson isn't a spoiler and Jill Stein isn't a spoiler, we'll actually see more people run because most people don't even bother because they know they're never going to win. They're going to be just the Garys and the Jills. We'll open that up and then either we'll get a new extraordinary political entrepreneur who will, you know, solve the problems, or they'll just put competitive pressure on Republicans and Democrats to have different kinds of priorities. And we'll start liking our choices better pretty darn quickly, and they'll start getting us some results.
You are listening to Catherine Gehl from one of the Game Changer webinar series put on by Humanities ND. The actual title of her talk is How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. You can find out more about this year's Game Changer series and many other free programs at humanitiesnd.org. And this particular edited version is available at prairiepublic.org. Back to the discussion. Dave Ailes is her questioner.
You hear the argument, and I'll have a quote by Thomas Jefferson: "The government you get is the government you deserve." So, you know, your hypothesis is that it's the system. The counter argument might be it's us. You know, we're so divided, we're polarized, and that's what's causing the problem. How would you respond to that?
As a business person, I would respond to that basically with what I call a ruthless practicality, which is, if people came to this today, they care, they're engaged, they want to see things be different. So what would be super unhelpful is to spend time figuring out what's wrong or who's to blame, even if we're blaming ourselves, if we have no way of activating a lever that would change that thing. No question, in this existing system, if everybody was super engaged and, you know, somehow we weren't divided, and if the media brought us together, and if there was some truth we all agreed on, that'd be super powerful. But there's no lever we could pull to create that. So what we have is this vicious cycle. And the question we have to ask is not where on this cycle can we find things that are wrong, because basically the whole cycle is kind of vicious, you know, media, division, election, you know, all of this. Instead, we just say, where could we get in there? Where could we find a chink in the armor and break open this vicious cycle? And the answer is by changing rules of the game that create the system. And then look, we're so divided because when you have a duopoly and only two, that's a really smart way to compete. You want people like your candidate, but it's also equally helpful in terms of winning an election to have them just hate the other side a lot and be the lesser of two evil wins the same as if you were loved. You know, as long as you get 50% plus one vote, you win. So if the best way to do that is to just make people hate the other side, then, you know, they're all over that. It's just rational behavior. If we change the rules of the game so that is not rational behavior, then they'll actually be incented while campaigning to not be demonizing. And then we'll actually start to have effects of division, because right now they've made again, the two has made everything existential. Half the country thinks that if these people are in control, we're just going to be the end of the world. And half thinks if these people are in control, it's going to be the end of the world. We can also see that what's going to be the end of the world is if we keep thinking that way, because we'll keep careening back and forth, either getting things done that are way over here and undoing them way over here, or careening back and forth and getting nothing done. So we're going to have to find a way to deal with the complex problems that our government has to deal with. I often say if our problems were simple, even this crummy government would solve them, a crummy political system. But, you know, we need to deal with complex stuff. So by changing the incentives, that's what we'll get there. And then I will say we get the government we deserve. Now that we know that these are the wrong rules and that there's a solution, which we'll get to, then I would say if we don't change that, then we're going to deserve, you know, what we're getting.
Well, maybe we could move to that then. How do we change it, Catherine? I mean, you have, and not just some great ideas, some great things that are happening already, right? And they just happened just recently, November in Alaska. But let's transition to that. What's the solution to get us to a better place?
Yeah, thanks for bringing up Alaska, Dave. Let's just start with that, because I might as well start with a proof point that what I'm about to tell you is totally doable. Because remember I said a moment ago, we should do things that are powerful, you know, change the likelihood that we get results from Congress, but we should also do things that we could achieve instead of just say, oh, if only. They're totally achievable. Here's what happened. What I'm going to talk about, you need to make these changes in each state. And Alaska had a ballot initiative for what's called final four voting, which I'll talk about, in November. And the citizens of Alaska passed that initiative. And so now they've implemented the system I'm about to tell you, and their elections beginning in 2022 will be held under those new rules. We see, for some of you that may watch the news a lot, you may notice that Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska has exhibited more independence from her party than she did previously, even though she was one of the more independent Republicans in the Senate. And she's able to do this because she's not a prisoner of the party primary anymore. She answers to her general electorate. She doesn't answer to Mitch McConnell. I'm not totally saying she ever did, but in general, you answer to Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or Paul Ryan. You answer to your party leadership. But once you're not a prisoner of your primary, you can be your own person and answer to your in-state constituents. Also a note, just because Senator Murkowski is using it to be more independent on the Republican side, let's be clear, the facts would be the same if it was a Democrat. And it doesn't mean that this system creates, you know, Lisa Murkowski exactly. It just creates this agency. Okay, sorry. Alaska was exciting. Here's what the solution is. We're going to change two things about our elections. The two things I said before were problems. We put them together in a package that's called Final Five Voting. The first piece of that package is, let's get rid of this broken party primary system. We're still going to have a primary. And what happens is now when you go to vote on primary day, there will be one ballot, not a Democrat primary and a Republican primary. There'll be one ballot. All the candidates running are on that ballot. Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Greens, Libertarians, the party for a fabulous North Dakota. You know, they're all running. You pick your favorite. Day ends, polls close. We count the votes. The top five finishers advance to the general election, regardless of party. You could have two Democrats and two Republicans and an independent. You could have three independents and one of each. Or because you can have competition even within a party. Not all Republicans are the same. Not all Democrats are the same. So now we're going to have, this is so exciting, we don't know who the winner is now. No matter how that district is skewed, we don't know who's going to win. We're going to have a real election in November. And voters who turn out, and that's when everybody goes, is in November, are going to have a choice and their votes are going to matter. That's exciting, first of all. Then the second thing is, now we have this super dynamic competition between the top, you know, the primary and the general, because you have these five different visions and innovative ideas, et cetera. So now the second thing we change is that we have to make sure, now that we have five, which is what we need, how do we not have them split the vote and have one of them be elected with, you know, like 21%, meaning that 79% of people wanted the others. We need to find a way out of those five, given that we need lots of choices, we need to find a way to say who's the most acceptable to the most number of people. So we use instant runoffs. And how we make this work is, when you go in for the general election, you'll see your five choices and you get to rank them in the order of preference, as in, this is my favorite. You fill in little circles. This is my favorite. This is my next favorite, all the way down to your
fifth choice, your last choice, something like, over my dead body, do I want this person to win? And then, and by the way, you don't have to rank them all if you don't know enough about them. It's fine. You can rank as many as you want to. But then when the polls close, now we count all the first choice preferences. And if out of the five, someone has over 50%, meaning a true majority, great. Election's over. That person wins. We don't need to do any runoffs. But if nobody got true majority support of all those people who spent their time to come to the ballot box that day, then it's very simple. We start doing runoffs. We drop the person who came in last place. And if a voter had selected that candidate as their first choice and that candidate's now out of the running, that voter's one vote, everybody only votes once, that voter's vote transfers to their next choice who's still in the race. We run the tallies again, see if someone's over 50%. If not, we drop the last place person, have another runoff. So you just have these runoffs until a winner emerges with the broadest support. And that is how we will transform, A, the choices that we have and our satisfaction with them. But remember, again, what we really care about is that they actually do things we want. And think about now the situation we talked about before. Senator Fred is your current senator, let's just pretend. And then Senator Fred gets reelected in this system. But now Senator Fred looks at that same bill and says to himself, now I know that my voters, you know, might want that their perfect view would be this, you know, but I know I can't get everything I want, you know, because voters come from other states, like a blue state. I got to work with these people. I think we can get this, and that on, you know, on balance is really good for North Dakotans. I'm going to vote yes, because under the old system, I never would have made it back through my party primary. But under this system, I'll be in the top five. You know, I mean, I'm the incumbent, I'm super well known. And then in the general election, maybe some people will be mad at me and I'll go from first place to second place, but maybe some other people will be happy with me. Because even though you're red state, there are other people there as well, you know? So, and then I'll put together this coalition of people who say, on balance, Senator Fred is doing a good job with solving these complex problems. And Senator Fred sees a path to reelection while doing, you know, this complicated business on all the problems that we haven't taken any action on in 20 years because no one can take action on them in the current system. And that's how we change it. So it's called Final Five Voting, Top Five Unified Primary, plus Ranked Choice Voting, Instant Runoffs in the general election, leads to more choice, more voice, better results, and as I like to think, you know, innovation, results, and accountability in the political system, none of which we have right now. We don't have innovation. We don't have results. We've been fighting about the same problems and the same policy solutions for two decades. We don't have, you know, this innovation, we're not getting the results, and we don't have accountability because we can't choose anyone else. All of a sudden, that transforms, and we get all three. I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, I really like your ideas, Catherine. And the question I think in many of our minds is, how do we make it happen, right? I mean, how did they make it happen in Alaska? And how can we make it happen? And I think there's some good news there, right? That it doesn't take a national or a federal effort to make it happen.
Right. Let me reach over here, actually. Okay, so this is my pocket constitution. And I like to bring this up just also to make one point we didn't make before. You know, look how short this is. Even if you haven't read it in a while, you can sort of imagine that all these rules about plurality voting or primary elections are not in here. It turns out that these rules that are hurting us so much, you know, aren't in the Constitution. We've, quote, just made them up. That means we can change them because what is in here is Article 1, and it gives the states all the power over the rules of how we elect people from that state to the House and the Senate in Washington, D.C. And so each state can change them individually, meaning you can get, you know, this more choice and better results coming out of North Dakota kind of as soon as you want. I mean, theoretically, your legislature could do it if they're in session now. The legislature can pass the bill, the governor can sign it, and you're all set. Now, also have in North Dakota ballot measures, right? So you can do exactly what, so you have two choices, meaning you can have your legislature, you know, pass the bill and the governor can sign it, or you can do exactly what Alaska did, which is you can follow the rules in your state for how you get a ballot question on most likely your November ballot in 2022. You know, do you vote to get rid of this party primary and replace it with the top five primary and get rid of plurality voting and replace it with instant runoffs? And then you vote yes or you vote no. And if the ballot measure wins, then you, again, are on your way. Now, you'll ideally want to win by more than just 50% plus one. You want to get a lot of buy-in for this. But you have those options. My organization works with leadership teams, in a sense, founders in various states who would be interested in starting these campaigns.
In your book, you talk a lot about the, we talked a lot about the elections and how to get how the way those are run will get better results because we get the right candidates with the right incentives, right? But there's also been a lot of changes actually within the mechanisms of Congress itself over the last 20 or 30 years, like the Hastert rule. So a question we have is, explain some of these rules within Congress that maybe even make the partisanship more hyper-partisan than it should be, like the Hastert rule.
Great, I will do that. And so fascinating how I consider myself pretty engaged, you know, throughout my adult life. But then when I really started looking underneath it, I discovered all these things that are super important and powerful that most of us just are totally unaware of. So I'm going to give you one example, which was horrifying to me when I discovered it and probably will be to you. So so here's the pocket constitution, right? And then over here, if I wanted to right now, print out the House rules book, this is what I would put in my printer. And then, if I thought I should also print out the Senate rules book, then I would add this. And I just love that example because this is not where we've gone wrong. This is crazy. And in here, I tell people, this is like, you know, not best practices of problem solving. It's really about how we're going to divide up these spoils of power. And it's so based on party advantage. So now here's a rule, the Hastert rule. And believe it or not, it's not even written down. It's not even in these pages, but it matters a lot. And what it says, it's named after former House Speaker. So like a Nancy Pelosi, you know, years ago, former House Speaker Denny Hastert. And it says that the Speaker in the House will not allow the House to vote on the floor on a bill unless a majority of the majority party, which is to say the Speaker's party, supports that bill. So what that means is that legislation that is supported by a majority of the country or a majority of the House won't even pass because there's not necessarily ever going to be a vote. Because if it's supported in a bipartisan way, then the Speaker doesn't necessarily want to do that. They only want to do, if they're a Democrat, things that are fully Democrat. And if they're Republican, they only want to do things that are fully Republican, even though this body is supposed to represent us all. And I'll give you a great example. It's from a while ago now, and there are plenty of newer ones, but this one really puts it in stark relief. So in 2013, we had a government shutdown. John Boehner was the speaker. And it is not known, but at the time, that was a 16-day shutdown. That shutdown could have been entirely averted, never happened, or ended earlier at any point in time if the House, if John Boehner had allowed a vote on legislation that was already passed by the Senate and that President Obama was willing to sign. And it had majority support. It had the votes in the House from day one, which is to say all of the Democrats, virtually all, plus a minority of Republicans. And so he didn't allow the vote. And in fact, the shutdown ended only when Speaker Boehner broke with his party and broke the Hastert rule to allow the vote. That shutdown cost us 16, wait, or was it 24 billion? I'm sorry, I might be getting my, it was 16 days. I think it might've been $24 billion, but some crazy number of billions of dollars for the shutdown, which 90% of the public never wanted and which had the votes right from the start. But that's because one person who is the Speaker of the House has that kind of power. And that was Boehner then, and that's the power Pelosi has now. And that's the kind of power that Mitch McConnell had when he was in control of the Senate, and that's the power that they're sort of dividing up right now between McConnell and Schumer. So those of us that don't have the Speaker or the House majority or the Senate majority leader from our state are in some ways at a disadvantage, but also it's crazy to think that one person has that amount of power in this legislature that belongs to us. And that should be totally not okay with us. And that's why there's never votes on anything. And that's why we don't do bipartisan things, because the party leaders aren't incented to let us do them. So that totally needs to change. We work first on the elections, because how you change the rules in the House and Senate is the people that are in the House and Senate have to vote to change the rules. And they're not likely to be able to do that until we change the rules of the elections. But it's definitely something to start thinking about. Whenever we hear in the news, you know, Mitch McConnell's not going to allow that vote, Nancy Pelosi is saying this, we need to think to ourselves, how did those people become the boss of all of us? I mean, we all elect the president, but how did those people become the boss? How did they become the boss of our representatives and our senators? And that will be an outrage that we got to, you know, get on in the future. And we can, and we will. And so I call these the elections machinery and then the legislative machinery. And we'll get on the legislative machinery as soon as we make some reasonable progress in the elections machinery.
You are listening to Prairie Public, and on Prairie Public, you're listening to Catherine Gell, who is talking about very specific political innovations that she thinks can help break partisan gridlock and make our democracy work better. This is part of the Humanities Indie Game Changer series from this year. Coming up next, duopolistic practices of the two major parties.
Our next question is about the nature of the competition itself. And the question is, isn't it true that the parties in the duopoly, so these two parties, are highly cooperative in a sense that they're highly motivated to keep it only two parties?
Oh, yeah. We think the competition is really intense, but let's make two notes here. Think how helpful that is in the industry, this intense competition. That industry, I don't know if this figure is right, but supposedly $500 million was spent in the Georgia Senate runoffs. That went into ads and pollsters and get out the vote and social media campaigns, meaning that industry just had a huge amount of revenue. So that kind of fighting is good, you know, for the industry and its revenue and power. And so in that sense, you know, they like this competition, but the other thing that's interesting, which the questioner brought up, is the parties work together. And by parties, I mean the parties plus their side of what we call the political industrial complex. They work together really super well in one particular way. And that is to, behind the scenes, rig the rules of the game to keep, to sort of protect themselves jointly from new competitors. That is to our detriment. Meaning, again, that means we don't have the choices we like, but let's not forget, it, what it really means is they don't have any pressure to solve problems for us because we can't go anywhere else with our business. I just had a meeting with someone today and he brought up once again, how come there's not an antitrust suit, you know, against these two parties? But you can imagine that ever so conveniently, since they make the antitrust regulation, it doesn't apply to the politics industry. And, you know, it's not that there's couple people in a room like being super evil about this. This is what happens when an industry grows unchecked and the people in the industry are themselves the ones that make the rules of the game. Each time they sort of change a rule and it just gets better and better for them. And it wasn't probably meant to turn out so horrible, but it did. And now it's time to know that they are really our rules. And so we can, you know, take them back and change them.
Thank you. Well, our next question is probably relevant to our state. The question is, how can we motivate one-party states to make changes that will lead to a lessening of their party strength? So I had a conversation with a friend of mine over the weekend as I was preparing for this, and he said, you'll never make that happen in North Dakota because you guys are, what's the motivation?
Oh, I love this question. Okay. I'm going to sound really maybe naive, but here's the thing. First of all, the biggest motivation is the country. You can't, there might be some people in politics, okay, who don't care, maybe, okay, but people don't get into doing this without caring deeply about the republic. Maybe that needs to overlap with their ambition, but so did my ambition overlap with running my food company and working as hard as I did. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. So people care, people are horrified at the trajectory we're on. Not everybody, but lots of people. And it is not limited to one party. So that is a big motivation. But then to get more ruthlessly practical, I will say, first of all, what I recommend in North Dakota is that you start where there's agreement, meaning Congress is broken. I agree with your friend who said to you, you're never going to get that through if what you aspired to was to change these rules on the heads of your state legislature and governor, because there's not agreement on that. Probably, you know, the Republicans in your state like perfectly well what's happening in your state legislature, and Democrats are unhappy, I assume, in some way if they control that. You know, you're not going to get agreement on that. But here's what and we also don't get agreement on the president, right? I mean, half the people are happy with yesterday and half the people are not happy with yesterday. But everybody's unhappy with Congress. Everybody. And believe it or not, Congress, I would still suggest, is more important than the presidency. And it is, according to our Constitution, the Article I branch, it's supposed to be more important. It's just so impotent now that it lets the executive be in charge of all these things that Congress should be in charge of. So what we do is we say to people, meaning in the legislature or, you know, through ballot initiative, let's start where we agree. Let's change these rules of the game for Congress. And what's going to happen in North Dakota is if you're a deeply red state and majority of Republicans, you're still going to elect Republicans. This doesn't accidentally trick Republicans into electing Democrats or Democrats into electing Republicans. It's just that it's probably that you would have choices of several Republicans on your ballot in November, and that other people's voices would also be heard in that choice, because maybe there would be a Republican that received more second choice votes from Democrats than other Republicans did, which would also, you know, bring us together in some ways. It's not a jobs reduction plan, same number of senators, same number of representatives. And now, and for those actual politicians, this is way better for them. They can go to Washington, D.C. and not be under the thumb of party leadership. Look, we're about to introduce our bill in Wisconsin. We're a legislative state, and our bill is going to circulate next week. And we have Republican lead sponsors and Democrats as bipartisan bill. We have the our largest Trump fundraiser. We had a fundraiser for in his home for Trump in 2016, as well as our one of our very largest progressive donors in the state. They're both saying we don't agree on anything except we agree on this final five voting. And we have Mike Gallagher, who's our representative in Congress, one of our federal delegation, a former Marine, writing a letter that goes with this bill saying, you know, dear colleagues in the state legislature, please pass this bill because I would be thrilled to go to Congress under these incentives. And if I were in a Congress with people elect, with other people elected under these incentives, we could collectively do a better job. Now, he is a conservative Republican. He's not planning that this makes it impossible for him to do things that he believes in. He's saying we could work together. And the way I did in the military, the way there were not two different teams when I was working on behalf of the country in the military, why are there two different teams when I'm working on behalf of the country, you know, in this way in Congress. So what I'm saying is we have to stop like thinking nobody wants it to be different. It's almost like we didn't even know it could be different. We have this learned helplessness. Like we think it's normal when say Pelosi decided, well, we should start being really horrified by that. And our legislatures think it's normal that McConnell's in charge of them or Pelosi's in charge of them or Schumer's in charge of them or something. I mean, how about the voters be in charge of them? You know, the voters in their state, which is to say all your, whoever, if you're, is your whole delegation Republican in North Dakota? Everybody? Okay, great. Probably still all be Republican. I mean, I'm assuming it would be sort of hard for them not to be. And that is great. But I bet people in your state, still many of them think Congress is broken. And I bet they would like their legislators to be able to be leaders. They're saying, let's come together, you know, lead this gang of whatever and solve something. And in the end, because you have ballot measure, if for some reason you can't convince politicians to go for it, you could get 60% of people to say that legislature belongs, that Congress belongs to us, and we want to change these rules. But I wouldn't assume that your governor wouldn't like to have a productive federal government. I bet your governor would very much benefit from having a productive federal government.
Well, thank you, Catherine. So I think we have one more question here. So this question is about name recognition and how people get on the ballot. So without the name recognition of someone like Lisa Murkowski, so as an example, how do candidates gain name recognition to advance through the primary without a lot of funding to get one's name and platform out? So if you have all these choices, you have five, how does that work?
Oh, love this too. This actually lowers the barrier to entry substantively to give room for like this political entrepreneurship. Here's how it works. So right now, the barrier to entry is you have to win a Democrat or Republican primary, which means you still have to compete in a primary. You need all that money. And you're usually running against, in your case, you're running against the red Republican and you got to beat that red Republican in the red primary. You're not going to win. So that is, you can imagine how much that costs, right? But now, to be one of five, if it's just, you know, the most votes, the next most votes, the fifth place person coming out of that top five primary probably doesn't get a lot of absolute votes, right? It's a low barrier to get onto that because maybe your incumbent already gets, you know, 46% of votes, or maybe get 60% of votes, in which case probably win straight away anyway, and as they should then. But nonetheless, that last place, you're not a really populous state too, so you won't need this enormous number of votes, which means you can say to yourself, to get on the general election ballot, I only need to motivate, you know, this small number of voters to turn out, and I can get myself the spot. And then once you're assured of the spot, what's very interesting about instant runoffs is that every one of those five has a potential impact in the race. Because the question would be, if this Amy Smith We don't think she's going to win, but, you know, she's got some momentum or whatever she's doing. You know, she's appealing to her voters. The question is, when she gets kicked off because she's in the last place, who are her voters going to choose next? So Amy Smith's positions are relevant to the debate. Not relevant enough that someone has to agree with Amy Smith, but the point being, if they're resonating with people, there is some decision-making from the other candidates. Is that a good idea or not a good idea? So all the candidates get earned media. And what that means is that they don't have to pay for it. So there's the difference when you're campaigning. Like, remember in 2016, it was said that Trump got all this free media because the news stations were covering him as news. So that's called earned media. And then making a campaign commercial is called paid media. So sometimes the startups, you know, these not known candidates, they don't have enough funding to do much paid media. But since they're relevant now, they'll be in the debates. They'll be in the earned media to more of a degree than they will be now. You don't eliminate like completely incumbency advantages, but you eliminate them a lot because, well, you decrease them a lot because now you have to appeal to this whole general electorate. So it is absolutely better for startup political entrepreneurs, because here's what I'll tell you right now, anybody who's a startup, they get those signatures, and then they're one of those people when you go to the ballot in November and you say, oh, here's my Democrat, here's my Republican, and I have never heard of these people. Who are these people? But now there will be no who are these people, because they would have been the ones whose names you're aware of since they came out of the primary. Now you might know them not as well as your favorite, et cetera, but it won't be the way it is now. It'll be substantively better.
Well, thank you, Catherine, so much. I just want to thank you for joining us here from the Humanities Council. I want to thank you for what you're doing. I mean, this is a tremendous work that you're doing. It's so important. We're thankful for that, and we appreciate it. Again, thank you very much.
It was, you know, good to be with you by Zoom. Someday, maybe in real life.
In real life would be great. That's Catherine Gell. She was interviewed by Dave Ailes of American Bank Corp, and she spoke as part of Humanities Indy's Game Changer series, which is focused on critical issues facing our democracy. It is sponsored, the Game Changer series, in part by the Paris Family Foundation. And I should mention that Catherine Gell co-authored a book with the noted academic and business planner Michael Porter, called The Politics Industry, How Political Innovation Can Break Partisan Gridlock and Save Our Democracy. Now, you can see future programs coming up from Humanities Indy by going to humanitiesindy.org, and you can also see recordings and listen to recordings of many things there. There's all kinds of material available. These slightly edited versions of the Game Changer Talks are available at prairiepublic.org as well. And I invite you to stay listening to Prairie Public this evening. There is wonderful and interesting music coming up next. Later tonight, we have On Being with Krista Tippett, The Global Village. And if you keep listening to Prairie Public, as with the talk you've just heard, we hope you'll hear a lot of interesting things. Stay tuned.